Welcome to Trailblazing Homeschool. I'm Melissa, a homeschooling mom of five.
And I'm RJ, homeschooling dad and credentialed teacher for over 8 years. Join us as we journey with families to discover their own path to education.
Hey mamas, do you have weeks or days where it just feels like the time flies by and you have no idea where it actually went? That's why I am in love with Danielle Roberts' new Faith and Focus time blocking notepad. It has a page for each week of the year, that's 53, and it's way simpler than a planner or digital, anything like that. Time blocking is an amazing resource where you can map out your week, get intentional about how you're using your time, and just see what you've been doing and what your schedule looks like. So if you're interested in taking more control over your week and time blocking, then you should definitely check out the Faith and Focus time blocking notepad. If you click the link in the show notes, that will take you there, or you can type in bit.ly/trail time block. Okay, we are back and we are going to be going through part two of learning styles today. So if you did not go and listen to learning styles part one, you definitely want to do that first. Otherwise, you're going to be kind of lost as far as to what we're discussing today. In the first part, we discussed the mind styles, which is based on the research of Gregork. So those were concrete, abstract, sequential, and random. Then we talked about learning modalities, which is the visual, oral, or auditory, read-write, and kinesthetic. And then we talked about environmental preferences, so setting up the actual room and space that your kid is learning in to facilitate their best learning. And today we are going to go through the rest of our learning styles and just all things learning.
Pretty much.
And we're gonna start with the multiple intelligences. And this is a list of 7 or 8, depending on which person, which studies and papers and things that you're following. But these have to do with, I don't even know. RJ, please explain to me multiple intelligences, because it's kind of a mystery to me and I need some help.
Okay. So when I was in grad school for education, they loved multiple intelligences. And they love to give us assessments and have us take assessments and how to take an assignment and reconfigure it for all the intelligences and rework lesson plans for all of them. And so they're just ways in which we learn. And
is it learn, but also kind of how we relate?
To some degree.
Because I think where I get a little lost is the differences. So we talked about like the modalities last time, and that like visual, aural, kinesthetic, like those make sense to me. But then we get into this multiple intelligencing and there's just so many more categories. So maybe we should read through those and then you can help break it down how it's different or similar maybe.
Okay. So the categories are, I'm going to start with the 7 and I'll tack on the 8th one for the other people. So the first one is bodily kinesthetic. Then we have interpersonal, then verbal linguistic, then logical mathematical, then intrapersonal, then visual and spatial, then musical, and finally naturalistic, which is the 8th one that they kind of tack on. So modalities covers similar things, right? They both have visual, they both have kinesthetic, they both have some version of aural or auditory, and those are kind of ways in which we take in information. And multiple intelligences kind of expands upon it and separates it out or adds it a couple extra categories. So bodily kinesthetic is exactly what you would think of. These are people who learn best by doing. And it can look a bunch of different ways. I know that we have a friend who taught our kid to read by having him jump on the letters, like letter tiles, like carpets, and threw them out and had him jump on the letters to spell words. And for him, that ingrained the movement itself ingrained the theory, right? Or what you're trying to teach. And we know this because we do this all the time. This is like hand motions for like kids songs.
That makes so much sense.
And so it helps you learn the song because you do the movement too. And so like we were at church the other day, and the children's leader was explaining how they did the motions, both to help the kids remember, but also as cues to the kids. So they don't have to prompt the kids if they get stuck on a verse.
Yeah,
they were
practicing memory verses to recite to the
And so
the
they could do the motion, which then triggers in the kid, oh, that's the next part of the verse.
Yeah.
And
which this was huge for me as a kid. Like, I loved songs with motions. I mm-hmm. love movement. I was a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it's like how you intake information, but also how you cue information. And this could also be like how for some people going through certain sets of motions helps them to get ready for the day, just part of their regular routine. Like, I need to stretch. You know, the people who have the same physical routine every day will help trigger the rest of the day. So it's like, if your first thing you do is you get up and you get a cup of coffee, like it triggers certain emotional, physical, psychological, all those things all move together. And bodily kinesthetic helps with that. So, it also helps to get out energy. So if you have kids that are high energy, just working in this may help them because it'll allow them to burn off energy while they're learning.
And the idea like with intelligence is that people excel more in things that are this area. So bodily kinesthetic people are going to be the more athletic, mm-hmm. The ones who move around and those sort of things.
Okay. Or like you might even see someone who like they like to knit and they can carry on a conversation while they're knitting, and the knitting actually helps them. I mean, if you think of like fidget cubes.
Oh yeah.
Fidget cubes is a kinesthetic way to pseudo distract your brain, allow you to move, and which then allows you to think. I know that men in general or boys in general think better when they're moving. I know I think better when I'm moving.
Yes, hence why you will walk laps around the backyard while having conversations on the phone.
And that's why even like recording this becomes slightly more challenging. And while if you were seeing me, you'd see me gesticulating a lot. I'm moving my hands a lot because it helps me think better.
Yeah.
So the next one is interpersonal. So inter, right? Together, personal, with other people. Interpersonal is just that. Some people learn better in groups than they do by themselves. I know that for me personally, especially in college, in my undergrad, going to study sessions, not the ones that like were proctored for you, but like informal study sessions where I could get together with classmates and discuss the study guide, I got way, way more value out of the discussion about what was on the study guide than I did the study guide itself.
Yeah.
Because in this regard, at least when it comes to academic stuff, I'm interpersonal. I like working together as like with other people. Same thing happened when I played paintball with my friends. I hated, you know, like one-on-one or every man for himself groups. I do not like working by myself in those kind of environments. Mm-hmm. I like working with a group. And the interpersonal...
Well, it also makes sense as to why you're naturally a teacher and like you like the feedback and you need the visual feedback of having a conversation with other people and bouncing ideas off of them.
Yeah, and so these are people who... Like, I don't generally like working in groups, like on a group project, but that's a different category. But these are people who like the interaction. The thing I miss most about teaching in a classroom is it's not even the teaching, like the formal teaching, it's the interaction with students outside of that formal teaching. Mm-hmm. It's the getting to know them as people, getting to interact with them, seeing how is what I said landing? Do they understand? Because I can read that on their face, and then being able to rephrase or work within what's going on to get the content across, even if it didn't work the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so verbal linguistic.
So verbal linguistic, you need to talk it out. Another one that I am good at, one way that I work is verbal linguistic.
You're strong in your verbal linguistic because you are a verbal processor.
If I don't talk it out, it doesn't work as well.
Which is why podcasting is really good for
you/us.
I think we're both verbal processors. I think when it comes to understanding ideas and processing even just hard decisions or talking through issues, we need to talk through them. We don't like that's a big thing for us.
Yeah, and I think verbal linguistic allows for these kind of people, it allows both for kind of a spitballing approach of just kind of like throwing stuff out there to see what it also in the way I visualize it anyways, is kind of a, you're able to verbally manipulate something, talk about it, talk around it, and I think of it kind of in a spatial sense of getting a feel for what it is by kind of discussing it so that you can get a shape to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to describe it other than you're processing, whether it's theories, thoughts, emotions, content, and then it allows you then to codify it, to get it all together in one thing. It also, the verbal linguistic is also helpful for explaining and then like just working with someone else. So this is where even if people who don't like working with other people, writing stuff down, if they'll write it down or talk it out, whether that's in prayer or just like talking to yourself, if you need to say it, needed to label it, so the words label it, it'll help you understand it better. Okay. So that's a verbal linguistic.
And then we have logical, mathematical.
So
that one, I mean, it seems, it makes a little more sense to me. The people who are very like numbers, logic, patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Usually the math savant type people.
Yeah. These are the people who start at the top of the instructions and read them all and then go back and read them again. And then they start whatever it is. Or they need a logical progression consistently, like in everything. And obviously mathematical, they think in those kind of categories. They want consistency, they want routine. And it's not, again, don't box someone else into this, but like a stereotypical would be kind of your Spock type character, your Vulcan, who's just very, this is the way things are, we do not deviate. And the deviations cause issues. And it's, like you said, patterns, math, those kind of things fit very well into that type of person, that type of learner. Okay, so the next major one is intrapersonal. This is someone intra, looking inward, spends a lot of time in inward thought, or they're looking internally for kind of homeostasis. And so if someone withdraws or studies best by themselves, like they don't like the interaction, or they don't want the interaction, they don't like being forced into groups. Yeah. If they can study, you know, in the library quietly, that's intrapersonal. They're not looking for outside stimulation in order to learn. They just kind of like want to sit with their book or do whatever it is they need to do. And again, remember, you never are one of these. You're always multiples. The question is what combination of multiples and to what degree?
Yeah, for sure. And we've got the visual spatial. So there's another one that describes me.
Yeah, visual spatial. And this one I think is interesting and a little bit different than the modalities in the sense that visual and modalities is more about taking in information, and visual spatial is slightly different in the sense that you're still taking in information visually, but it also is the ability to, in your mind, manipulate spatial things.
Yeah, visualize in your mind and you kind of, you know, create those models.
Yeah, so it's like, can you take the three-dimensional object and shift it 90 degrees on the x-axis in your head and then redraw it? Mm-hmm. Without having to, like, you know, go through the mechanization, or even worse, you know, flip it 180 degrees on the Z axis. So it's the one coming straight towards you. So you're like, I'm taking this thing and I'm rotating it a completely different way than it was. And then think of like Tetris, but like Tetris in your head. And it's like seeing it in advance and being able to place, like, what do I need to do to this object in order to make it fit?
Well, I even think in a more like real life practical sense, like they're the person that can look at a room and see if you rearrange the furniture this way, this is what it will look like.
Or yes,
if you're planning out a garden, you can look at the whole space and go, okay, I'm going to have this, the pumpkins here and the tomatoes there and the corn here, and the beans here, you know, like being able to visualize and fit things into space without having to sit there and
measure
and remeasure and draw it out. And
so when you think of like the stereotypical like dad packing, right, where it's like they're out there with, you know, the hatchback trying to fit every bag in there, that's a visual spatial person. I do that when I pack. I look and be like, what else can I fit in here? And I go look for things to fit into whatever spot I have.
Yeah. And that is a more predominantly male thing.
Yes.
I mean, as in men excel more often than women at the visual spatial.
And part of that is biological. Like women, girls almost always get fine motor skills and get verbal skills first, as where boys almost always get gross motor skills and spatial reasoning first. And part of that, depending on what perspective you come from, the kind of hunter-gatherer idea of like, well, your job is primarily to hunt. Mm-hmm. And so you need to be able to track things with your eyes quickly and understand distance and force much more, you know, quickly. It's a much more valuable thing. Meanwhile, women, being stereotypically the gatherers, have one, your field of vision includes more colors. Mm-hmm. You actually physically see more colors than we do. And you have a more sensitive sense of smell, and you smell more things than we do. And there's nothing we can do about it. So it's kind of one of those, like, visual spatial kind of fits into that category of two, that spatial reasoning, what fits where, estimating size and length, understanding things on a map. Like, I may not be able to tell you exactly where that particular country is on the map, but I can give you a pretty good ballpark within a couple hundred miles, probably, in most cases for most countries on the planet. But that's a visual spatial thing where I can draw on a whiteboard freehand a rough map of the world, and you'd be able to identify what it is. And there's other people who couldn't draw their living room on a map they see every day with any sort of scale or size. And those people are clearly not strong visual spatially.
Okay, so the last of the seven is musical. So obviously these are people who have a gift in music, not necessarily that like they're automatically a musical savant or something like that, but just the idea that they can even think in music and sound. And I know, mm-hmm. like growing up as a musician and a singer myself, you almost like think in song, mm-hmm. and it's a very different world.
Exactly. And this is the one I have the hardest time with. I like music. I like listening to music. I talked about on the last podcast being distracted by lyrics, you know, but my roommate in college was a music major, and he could do things with music that flabbergasted me. Just completely outside of my experience, mm-hmm. because he was able to think even at instruments he doesn't play. Mm-hmm. So he can conceptualize, oh, this is what a violin sounds like playing this note. And I'm like, I can pick out a violin, but that's about as far as I go. And so musical people are more given to rhythm. Like, they're just good at it.
And rhythm and meter and sound and song help us both bring stuff in, absorb, but also express.
Yeah. And actually, you know, what it reminds me of is there's that You Ain't Got Rhythm from Phineas and Ferb. Oh. It's a great song where they're trying to get the band back together. And there's the drummer who apparently fell asleep in a metronome factory and lost his rhythm. But he's a librarian now, and he's like stamping books and stuff, and he's doing a rhythm right there. And so they have this entire song.
I think it won a Grammy. I'm pretty sure that song won a Grammy.
And it should have, because it was great. But that's one of the things where it's like, it's the kind of person who just does it. Like, they don't, you know, it can be cultivated, obviously, and flourished into something much bigger. But it's like their natural bent is towards music. Their natural bent is to understand, to feel it. I had a student a couple of years ago who, he was autistic, kind of in the moderate range. And he couldn't read music, but you give him an afternoon and he can play it.
Yeah, if he listens
like
to
a new instrument, like a brand new instrument. He could pick it up in, I think he played 15 or 17 instruments as an 18-year-old. And for graduation, he played a piece on the piano, which was his rendition of a piece that he made up as he went. So he took a piece that had it, like, you know, he knew how to play the whole piece in its traditional form and was kind of embellishing it.
Riffing
on it as he's playing it, never having practiced it before. Wow. Just kind of, that's the way his brain works. And I just stand in awe of that, because that is so not me. I do not understand it at all. Yeah. But those are musical people.
Okay. And then there's this eighth intelligence that certain groups didn't include, but then has been added on since then. And that's the naturalistic. So what is a naturalistic intelligence?
So a naturalistic intelligence is kind of hard to explain, in the sense that it is people who kind of intuitively know or experience, understand, like, the real world environment.
Like nature.
Nature in particular. And the best way I could probably describe it is that they understand the systems and the patterns, and they're really both intrigued and engaged in them. So these are the kind of people who will notice slight differences in the environment, mm-hmm. that will notice and be able to, like, you know, like if you think of like a kind of like a gardener, someone who does it for the joy of gardening, they can tell that the plant is not doing well, even if everyone else is like, but it's fine. And they're like, no, there's something off, right? There's those kind of people where they can, it's not just a familiarity with a particular thing. It's not like, oh, I know my horse. It's like, I can tell there's something wrong with that horse, even though they don't know that horse, mm-hmm. because of the way, those kind of people, they understand the way things work in the environment. They understand the changing of the seasons. They feel safe there. They feel comfortable there. They love it there. And there's a natural kind of rhythm and flow within them, kind of like with music. It's way more intuitive than it is like testable.
Yeah.
Like you can see people who fail at this miserably much more easily than you can see people who's really gifted, but you will see those people that are kind of, they just know.
Yeah.
And it's not from
connection.
They just have a connection and they'll learn better counting sticks or pine cones than they will counting Skittles, mm-hmm. or paper tiles or whatever it is. They're emotionally engaged, they're psychologically engaged best when they're in a natural environment, and you'll find them climbed up in trees and just walking around or laying in the grass. They love being outside in nature. It brings them some sort of peace and calming, and they can learn things that you would not think were learnable, because they'll come in and they'll be like, so I was watching this bird and this is what I got. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what? Well, they were watching this bird and this is what I got. And actually a great example of this, at least to me, I was reading a biography of Teddy Roosevelt, and he had to go on a diplomatic mission to England, and his own memoirs, he kind of gave like a couple pages to the entirety of this major diplomatic mission. And he spent the rest of it explaining how excited he was to go and see birds that he'd only read about. Like, he's like, yeah, I have to go to London and I have to meet the Queen and I got to do all this stuff. But really, really, really what I'm looking forward to is going and seeing this and like going out into the woods and seeing these things. That's a naturalistic's heart right there.
All right. So those are the 8 multiple intelligences. And I think there's just so much that you mm-hmm. can dive into all of these things. Mm-hmm. So again, we're going to include a lot of links to further resources to where you guys can dive deeper into these areas and study whatever intrigues you the most and what mm-hmm. you kind of connect with. Okay, so the next one that we wanted to just touch on really briefly was the idea of internal and external motivation. And really what this revolves around, especially when it comes to, I think this is helpful when you have kids who aren't very compliant and aren't wanting to do their schoolwork and are just fighting back with you, knowing whether they are internally motivated, meaning that they are doing things for their own, I guess, gain, their own accomplishment. They aren't looking for anyone else's approval. They want to feel achievement in their own self. So that's the idea of the internal or intrinsic motivation. The external motivation or extrinsic motivation is the idea that they are more motivated by either earning a reward or avoiding punishment.
Mm-hmm. Character stick.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we tend to assume most kids are externally motivated. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to give you a timeout. I'm going to, mm-hmm. Take away this, or, oh, you can earn these rewards if you do this thing. And those work, period. Mm-hmm. Like it's, again, kids are never fully one or the other. But if you have a kid that is much more internally motivated and you're constantly trying to use the idea of the, rewards or punishment, and it's just not working, then you might need to look at, okay, my child is not motivated by this external mm-hmm. forces, so I need to dive mm-hmm. into more of how to internally motivate them to achieve, accomplish, complete, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think that there's also different people are motivated externally by different things. Mm-hmm. So some people might be motivated by free time, Other people might be motivated by time to do what they want. Other people might be motivated by money or by, you know, our kids are heavily motivated by sugar. You can get them to do just about anything if you offer sugar in enough quantity in the right form. But but that's the kind of external motivation or avoiding punishment. But internally or intrinsically motivated people, internally motivated people, it's more about who they are. Oftentimes, like, are they doing it because they want to do it, or are they doing it because they have to do it?
Yeah.
And if you're having to use extrinsic motivation, it's not a bad thing, but it's going to look different than if they're internally motivated. I don't have to encourage my daughter to bake. She does that by herself. She's intrinsically motivated to bake. She just likes doing it, so she wants to do it. So we have to, like, rein her in as opposed to encourage her to do that type of things. We also don't have to motivate her to try something new when it comes to baking, because every single time she bakes, she tries something new, which is actually quite frustrating. But it's that kind of thing of, like, and it can be in different areas. Mm-hmm. And different kids are motivated by different things. Some kids might be motivated by time with you. Other kids might be motivated by time away from you, you know, like.
And that feeds into something that we're not really touching in this episode, but might be a good thing to talk about down the road, is the idea of, like, love languages and Gary Chapman and the five love languages.
Just keep that in mind, because I know that, like, I generally am an intrinsically motivated person, and the externals that do motivate me are things like time, like free time. I am intrinsically motivated to get stuff done so that I have free time.
Yeah.
If you take away the free time, I will still get stuff done, but I will not be a happy person. But it's knowing that difference and being aware of that, and then trying to figure out, like, where am I externally motivated? Where am I internally motivated? Does that need to shift? Because it's kind of like when you're creating discipline, like, they teach us this in school. Like, if you want to create discipline in your classroom, the best way to do that is to, in the beginning, like, think of, like, training a dog, right? In the beginning, you give a lot of rewards. And then as it, over time, those rewards reduce and reduce to the point where they become, like, literally random. Like, sometimes you get it and sometimes you don't, but you have no idea when. But eventually, the goal is not that I have to give you a cookie every time you do what I want you to do. It's that you become intrinsically motivated to something you just do because it's become a part of who you are.
Yeah.
And so really, typically, extrinsic is a temporary state to motivate intrinsic value, right? Like with a work ethic, maybe you have to make them work. But once they associate internally with this idea that, no, I can get a lot of work done and I'm good at it, then it becomes its own intrinsic motivation to continue to get work. That's like a work ethic, right? That idea of a work ethic.
Exactly. But that's a good thing to keep in mind. Okay, so the last thing that we wanted to talk about, kind of summing all of this up, right? So we've done two episodes here on learning styles and how to use them in, you know, just helping guide your homeschool and your learning and just life in general. But one thing that I found really important, and this is, I think, one of the last chapters in How They Learn, is the idea of a learning style versus a learning disability or difference. And this is powerful to me because I know that, especially here in the US and here in California, we love a diagnosis. We love a label. We love a box. And there's just a huge rise in diagnoses of things like ADD, ADHD, autism, all of these things. And I don't pretend to have a deep understanding of a lot of it because we do not have children with major learning disabilities or learning differences. We don't have any diagnoses. Partially because we haven't taken any of them to get diagnoses. But sometimes I think, especially in a traditional school setting, a kid will get labeled as ADD because they have a hard time sitting still in their chair at a desk or a table listening to the teacher. And so we want to slap a label on that of, like, oh, they have a problem, when really it's maybe that they're just a kinesthetic learner and they need to move and they're trying to, you know, suppress that part of them as best they can, but the reality is that they just need to move around, and it's not necessarily a learning disability or learning difference.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we also need to be gracious with our children and realize that these learning differences and these learning disabilities are real. They are not made up. I do not think that it's all in our heads. It's not just this pretend excuse. It's not an excuse. There are real chemical differences in, you know, brain scans. Like, they exist. The science is there to show that these exist and that they affect people, and they affect people differently. So don't be afraid that if you are just hitting wall after wall after wall, or frustration, or your kids are not learning the way that you feel that they should, and you've tried a lot of different stuff and you've tried different learning styles and modalities and, you know, all of this stuff, don't be afraid to go and seek out help. You know, seek out your pediatrician or a psychologist or psychiatrist and get the evaluations that you need to help you understand how to allow your kids to learn and not be hindered by something like that.
Yep. I think that it's learning styles are something that can help, can go a long way for the majority of people to limit what might otherwise be labeled a disability or a difference. Because sometimes, yeah, maybe your kid does have ADD, but really what they need to do is they need to go spend 3 hours outside playing before they try to do school. Or maybe they need to have a different routine, a different schedule, those type of things. So I think that's about it. We're going to wrap it up for today, and we're going to head off and record more episodes for you later.
All right. Well, thanks you guys for listening in, and we will talk to you soon. Hey guys, Melissa here again, real quick to ask you a huge favor. If you could head over to iTunes and leave a review for this podcast, that would be amazing. Our podcast can only reach people if they know it exists. So please leave us a review on iTunes. And if you love this episode or any of our episodes, make sure to share it with your friends, send it to them, or tag us on Instagram at Trailblazing Homeschool. If you want to learn more about us and how you can connect with us, head over to our website, www.trailblazinghomeschool.com. Of course, all those links are in the show notes.